I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker, comes from a family of psychiatrists. His father, his grandfather, and great-grandfather were all practitioners. He writes that he was raised in a family that believed everyone had a little mental illness. That's from his new book, Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. He traces the history of how those viewed as mentally ill have been treated in this country. For instance, the Puritans believed that anyone without reason, and that included children, should be disciplined like animals. Things changed with the evolution of treatment over punishment, a greater understanding of the traumas of war, and today a greater acceptance of diversity. Grinker is also the author of Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism, inspired in part by his daughter who is on the autism spectrum. He's a professor of anthropology and international affairs at the George Washington University, and he joins us on Radio Times today by Skype. Roy Richard Grinker, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So what was it like growing up with this idea that everyone has a little mental illness? How was that talked about in your family?
Well, you know, my grandfather and my father both were practicing psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, and my grandfather ran a large hospital and with an inpatient service and about 95 researchers who were doing work on the relationship between physical and mental illness. And so I never really developed this idea, at least in my early childhood, that if somebody had a mental illness, it was completely separate from any other kind of illness. It was a form of suffering like any other. It took me a little while to realize that. Whereas I think for a lot of other people, the stigma of mental illness kind of comes to the fore much earlier.
And what does anthropology give you in helping you understand mental illness that psychiatry, and I'm assuming there might have been some kind of pressure on you to be a psychiatrist, like the men in your family, what does anthropology offer you as a way to understand this?
Well, you know, from a personal perspective, I chose anthropology in part because I didn't want to compete with my family. I saw them as giants in the field, and I was insecure. And when I found anthropology, I thought, wow, here's a way that I can approach psychology without having to do what they do. But really what anthropology does is, because it has an international perspective, it allows us to see that the way that we view the world at any particular point in time isn't the way we have to view the world. That it is culture that makes it so. And so every society can find a way to demean or marginalize or shame somebody, but they do it in very different ways. And so when we look around the world, we find that there are societies in which people do much better if they have schizophrenia than they do here. Or there are people who do much better with depression than they do here. We also find the opposite, where there are places where people do worse. Many people think the goal of anthropology is just to sort of describe other cultures. But the real aim is to study other cultures so that we can come back to our own society and sort of see it in a new light.
And one more question about your family, and specifically your grandfather. As you write about him, part of his mission was to work to eradicate the shame and stigma of mental illness. And you have carried that on.
Well, I have. I've tried to. My grandfather was very influenced by Sigmund Freud. He studied with Freud in Vienna for a couple of years in the 1930s before Freud fled the Nazis. And what Freud always told him was that mental illness should become something that we can talk about and not something that we demean and shame. And the whole history of the stigma of mental illness has been one that's kind of roller coaster. It's up and down. There are times when we're more accepting. There are times when we're not. And I wrote Nobody's Normal because I wanted to figure out if we were doing something right now. And if we're doing something right, can we stay the course? And I've had, you know, personal experience of this with my daughter, who was diagnosed with autism in 1994 at a time when it was very shameful and uncomfortable and tragic, and something that you really didn't talk about openly. And now we do. So why are we getting to a place where we're we're doing better. That's what I want to find out.
And I do want to get to that because I thought that gives us really a lot of things to talk about. But I want to understand how you see the roots of this stigma of mental illness, considering, and even the word mental illness. I know the book is filled with that word, and I want to make sure that we're all on the same wavelength when we're talking about that. You do not use the word mental disorder, but what do you mean by mental illness?
One of my teachers in school, Arthur Kleinman, anthropologist, he was always clear that disease and disorder, words like that, are really the technician's words. Those are the words of the doctor. But if we really want to understand what a condition is, we need to understand the full life of somebody. We need to know all the facets of their existence. You know, so you can take a physical illness like cancer, say a breast cancer, and you can look at the tumor under a microscope and you can say, well, there's this disease. But there is a larger illness, which includes the changing attitudes that the person has about themselves, the way their social life changes, the way their finances change, the way their vision of the future changes, the way their work life changes, the relationship with their children. None of that can be seen in a microscope, right? So the illness is the idea that we see something in its full complexity as experience, and not just, you know, something's wrong with your brain or something's wrong with your blood. Now, the word disorder, too, I think, echoes all kinds of old ideas about, you know, a mind being lost or a screw loose or you've gone nuts and things like that. And we don't know what a disordered mind or an ordered mind looks like, but we do know what suffering is. And that's why I call it illness.
Well, and it's interesting to think about the roots, as you write, of the stigma of mental illness, knowing how common it is, whether we're talking about anxiety or depression. I mean, I'm thinking of my own family, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, I have schizophrenia in my family. I had relatives who really suffered with paranoid delusions and talking to themselves. And so it's interesting that we have a stigma about something that is so common.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The roots of it, you know, the roots of stigma are not just in the sort of history of industrial societies in which we've sought to value highly people who produce a lot and to negatively value those who don't, to value people who can be independent and negatively value people who are dependent. But it also intersects with racism and sexism and classism and all forms of other discrimination. So if we think about mental illness stigma in isolation, we don't see the full picture, which is that African Americans in this country were often denied any kind of psychological care. Even today, children with autism who are African American are diagnosed later or misdiagnosed and not given the same kind of accommodations as their white counterparts. Women were thought and often are still thought to be more prone to mental illness. And class also has played a huge role throughout the course of the 20th century. So it's important that we see that mental illness stigma is part of a larger kind of deep structured institutionalized process.
Your subtitle, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. And as you said, depending on where you are in the world, there's a different approach to that. But your book is really about the stigma in America, and we are a capitalistic country. How much do you think just the fact that people need to be productive and we're highly individualistic, that has created some of the stigma?
Oh, I definitely think that's the case. And I think that's one of the reasons why we continue to have more stigma with conditions that threaten our ideals about autonomy and self-control. So as much as we've made great progress in neurodiversity with autism, as much as we've made great progress in sort of normalizing depression and anxiety and PTSD, we still have a big problem with addiction, substance abuse, schizophrenia, because those particular conditions challenge these long-standing ideological ideas in the United States that, you know, we are autonomous individuals who should be, you know, accountable for and masters of ourselves.
Does our culture drive us crazy then?
Well, all cultures drive some people crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to give you an interesting example. I did work in Namibia, and there was a man named Tomzo who heard voices, angry, frightening voices. And he went to a healer who was able to quiet the spirits a little bit. But he eventually went to a Norwegian clinic that was in Namibia, and they gave him an antipsychotic medication. And they wrote down his diagnosis, and they wrote schizophrenic, because I saw this in his chart. But when you went to his village and asked them if he was sick, they said, well, he was, but now he has this medicine and he's not sick anymore. On top of that, they saw the illness not as something that was wrong with his brain, but as something wrong with spirits that had randomly entered into his body as revenge for a crime of an ancestor. And so just 12 miles apart, you have two totally different conceptions of what this person's condition is. In the village, he's seen not to be sick if he doesn't have symptoms. He's not labeled for the rest of his life. And he is not seen to be at fault for his condition. 12 miles away, he's a schizophrenic with a brain disorder. So it is culture that shapes the way in which we view someone's suffering.
It would be interesting to know whether he felt better because of the medication.
Oh, he did. He walked 12 miles once a month to get those medicines. Those medicines were incredibly important to him. I think it was also a kind of lesson in that we can combine different viewpoints. You know, you don't have to just say, well, I'm going to see my condition as a brain disorder and not as something that's related to discrimination or poverty or other. We can see all of these things interacting. There's just a real seduction in the United States, I think, to try to reduce mental illnesses to like a single cause.
We're almost up in a break here. You were talking about schizophrenia, and I remember decades ago that that mothers were blamed for schizophrenia. They were called refrigerator mothers, and they were allegedly cold and uncaring, and it was their fault that someone got schizophrenia or was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Can you speak to that just briefly, Roy?
Oh, absolutely. Refrigerator mothers is one term. The more technical term people used was the schizophrenogenic mother.
Right.
And Bruno Bettelheim championed this idea in the 1950s and 1960s, and he encouraged children, parents who had children with autism, for example, to be institutionalized, to get away from what he called their mother's black milk. Ooh. And there was a generation of two generations of mothers who just felt enormous shame and just horrible pain that they – because they believed these doctors, that they had somehow caused their child's autism.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Roy Richard Grinker. We're talking about his new book. It's called Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. Much more after this very short break, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker about his new book. It's called Nobody's Normal, and it examines the history of mental health stigma in this country and some of our progress towards a culture more accepting of neurodiversity. He comes from a family of psychiatrists dating back generations, and he's got a daughter on the autism spectrum. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk to you more about autism. As you mentioned, you have a daughter. She was diagnosed in 1994, and the time frame between 1994 and today is just enormous. What we have learned about autism in those intervening years is really groundbreaking. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I was one of the people who really made the argument early on, I think, that the increase in the diagnostic rate of autism was not an epidemic, but that we were identifying it more. that we were understanding it more, that we were finding that the framework of autism as a diagnosis helped. I remember, you know, every year the CDC would come out with new statistics that would say that the rate had increased from 1% to 1.2 and 1.4, and the media would say, what's happening? And I argued that the true rate was much higher. In fact, I did an epidemiologic study in South Korea with a bunch of colleagues in which we found that the rate there in a suburb of Seoul was approximately 2.64%, much higher at the time than the CDC had estimated. But I see this increase in the rate of autism as a good thing in the sense that people are getting services that they didn't get before. And we're understanding that autism is a much larger category that can capture a very big spectrum of people, from those who need lifelong care, but also those who really can benefit from help, from mental health care, from speech therapy, from occupational therapy, but who are less impaired and, you know, have great abilities. I mean, we're seeing people with autism now who are, you know, doctors, engineers. You know, that we have this TV show, The Good Doctor, about a man with autism who becomes a good doctor. And we don't yet have, you know, the full range of autism portrayed in the media, but I think great, great progress. And today there are people who use the word positively instead of reflecting all of that shame that we talked about before.
Well, I mean, and this is making a broad generalization. I'm thinking of all, you know, the nerds in my life who probably have
This is the revenge of the nerds. The technology.
Exactly. Have a little piece of that autism that, you know, makes them function very well.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I want to say is that the changing views about autism and the incorporation of people with autism into the workforce has been a tide that has raised all boats. Yeah. I met a man who runs a company in Australia, a cybersecurity company, and he started an autism program where he would hire people on the spectrum to do work on coding, computer coding. And after he started this program, people started to come to him if they had depression or anxiety because they saw that he was understanding. And recently a woman came to him and said, you know, I'm not sure I'm having problems at work, but I'm having symptoms related to menopause. I'm going to the bathroom a lot. I'm not feeling quite myself. I feel like my temperature regulation is off. And he looked at me, this man, Michael Fieldhouse, and he said, how did this happen? You know, 20 years ago, do you think a woman would have come to her male manager about a problem that was a, you know, female problem, even though it's, you know, of course, normal hormonal changes over the development of lifespan, and call attention to herself as an aging woman at that? And he really thought that it was the autism program that had kind of generalized to influence all of these other kinds of changes in the workforce.
You tell a really lovely story about your daughter, Isabel, and you write, I once saw stigma appear and disappear within seconds when Isabel graduated from high school, and you talk about her delivering this graduation speech.
Yes.
What happened? I mean, it was a real before and then after.
Oh, yeah. It was remarkable. It's actually, there's a video of it on Facebook somewhere. but she was the first person with a disability to give a graduation speech at this particular high school that she went to, in which she had special education services throughout. And when she started to talk, she talked in her sing-song voice. She has an odd rhythm. She doesn't really sound like you would expect a graduation speech to have. And you could hear people in the crowd kind of murmuring and snickering and kids laughing and whispering to each other. Because it was unusual.
Yeah.
And then when she said, kids with autism like me, there was suddenly quiet. Because now they had a framework to understand that difference. And they had a framework that they had learned. These are kids. I mean, the kids, I think the kids were a lot more savvy than a lot of the teachers. They understood autism, and then they quieted down and they listened to it, and she had a standing ovation at the end. And it was an incredible experience to see. And it really said to me, you know, this is the change. This is the change that we've made autism into a non-stigmatizing framework. It's not blaming parents. It's not shaming and marginalizing people anymore. It's become a framework that we have come to accept as part of the human condition.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker. He's a professor at the George Washington University, and he's got a new book, and it is what we are talking about. It's titled Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. And again, you can join us. We've got some folks that do want to join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me just toss out a couple of other things, and then we'll get to some of our listeners here. But I was thinking about handedness, and it wasn't so long ago, maybe a generation or two ago. If you were left-handed, people tried to make you into a right-handed person. Now we don't do that anymore. I was also thinking when being homosexual was considered a disorder, the DSM, you know, had a diagnosis for someone who was gay or lesbian. That's not true anymore. President Biden just said that if you are transgender and you can pass all the qualifications, you can serve in the military. Is that kind of what you're talking about, where we go from disorder to just difference?
Well, I think that the important thing is that we see that no one is immune to mental illnesses. Someone who is transgender can have a mental illness. Someone who is gay can have a mental illness. But being trans or being gay is not itself a mental illness. I remember my younger daughter had a conversation with my father at when she was in college, and my father was saying that, you know, he still thought, he's 90 whatever 3 years old, he still thought homosexuality was a mental illness, and she strongly objected to it. And he said, but I treated people who were gay and they were all unhappy. And she said to him, yeah, but first of all, you're a psychiatrist, so you only treat people who are unhappy. Secondly, if the person was unhappy because of discrimination and shame and intolerance, does that still make it a mental illness? Well, the reality is, yes, that there are examples in which discrimination and social injustice can cause great suffering. But who you are, whether you're trans or you're gay or you're left-handed, does not in itself make you anything less than or make you pathological. I mean, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a year or two ago in which I argued they needed to get rid of the category of gender dysphoria because it made it sound like just being trans was a mental illness. And I also, in the book, in Nobody's Normal, I talk about many societies throughout the world that have multiple genders without any shame.
And I think we're moving in that direction. I'm thinking of, you know, the use of pronouns, for instance, where that is just becoming very normalized.
And I think the great thing is that that there are so many advocates, you know, transgender advocates, gay advocates, who are taking ownership of these words, of the meanings, and redefining them. I mean, that's really the key. The real heroes to me are the people who say, I am trans, and this is why and what it means to me, and I'm going to define what it means, rather than relying on some, you know, group of experts who by consensus create some sort of, you know, biomedical model. The real heroes for me are my students, who come up to me after class and on the first day of class and say, I have Tourette's syndrome, I have ADHD, I have an anxiety disorder, to let me know how I can be a better teacher to them, but also to let me know that they are taking control and being their own agents for advocacy.
Let me read a comment or two, and then we'll take Paul from Wildwood. Maurice says, my brother in 1969, when he was 19, had a psychotic break. He was diagnosed as having paranoid schizophrenia. My parents refused to accept it and allowed doctors to do a spinal tap in order to diagnose a physical disorder. Worse yet, they stigmatized it to such an extent that I now have neurotic fear of mental illness. Though he is fine today, I suffer with anxiety. Maurice, I'm really sorry to hear that. But and if maybe I can toss that to you, Roy, just about just the pain associated with an experience like that, a family pain.
Yeah, I mean it's crushing, especially when you feel that the person is not getting care, and that the this is an example of how Maurice's examples is about how mental illnesses are double illnesses. You know, there's the ailment itself, and then on top of it, society's negative judgment. And that's just that's a lot to deal with. And particularly when you have intergenerational conflict. I don't know why I thought of this when you read her comment, but I was thinking about all the people who at my university, George Washington University, were lobotomized. You know, because their parents wanted them to be fixed, not just to alleviate suffering, but to actually sort of fix them and make them conform to some sort of ideal of normality. John F. Kennedy's own sister was lobotomized at George Washington University. It caused her permanent brain damage. So I think that there are many, many examples of this, but equally there are examples of people who don't get any care at all. I mean, Maurice's example sounds like bad care. I mean, there are people who don't get any care at all. And that's a big barrier we have to overcome, particularly for serious mental illnesses.
Absolutely. Let me get Paul from Wildwood to join our conversation. And Paul, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm just curious about, maybe it's a question of classification or definition, the difference between someone, let's say, who's disheveled and walking around in a public place, mumbling to himself, or maybe even shouting out loud, which is, you know, a clear case of some type of classic mental illness. And people who, like, for example, those who invaded the Capitol a couple of weeks ago, who believed something and acted on it, and it was, I would have to say, both criminal and somehow crazy. I just wonder how you would look at that. And then, of course, and with just a bit of humor, if you would care to diagnose Mr. Trump on the radio.
Yeah,
thanks
well,
very much.
Okay, Roy Richard Grinker is an anthropologist. I'll put that out there. But I'd be curious, Professor Grinker, what you say to Paul about sort of this, how we understand, I guess, what looks like extreme behavior.
Yeah, I think that the difference really that I would emphasize is one between an individual that is suffering an enduring problem, like somebody with schizophrenia, versus a group of people who find a set of beliefs and values that are culturally sanctioned in some way. Now, I don't mean it's culturally sanctioned by everybody, but by the groups and the people that they are talking to. And so, you know, there are many, many instances in which people do things and believe things in large groups that they wouldn't by themselves. Right. And so I think the issue there, you know, is the really important collectivity, that when people come together, they often act in ways they would never act alone.
A Facebook comment from Tom, who says, does your guest believe that this past year has increased depression and distress in our country or maybe even around the world? I don't know if you've looked at that, Roy Grinker.
Great question. Yes. My colleagues and I at George Washington University are doing a study on funerals and death and grieving during the pandemic. But one of the things that the experts are finding is that there are a lot of new onset psychiatric disorders. There was a paper recently in The Lancet showing that within the first 3 months after a positive COVID test, 18% of people met the criteria for a mental illness, and 5% of people had a first-time mental illness. Now, what I'm trying to say here is that these are not abnormal people, right? These are normal people under abnormal circumstances. And if you've got 5% in this sample of must be 65 million medical records that they looked at, with a new onset mental illness, having never had a psychiatric history, that's really telling you that external stressors create a major mental health problem. And I think that is something that we need to address at the highest levels of the U.S. government, frankly.
Are you talking about, I can imagine, anxiety, depression? I mean, those kinds of mental illnesses?
Yes. Anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, suicidality itself, addiction, substance abuse, and so on. And, I personally have experienced more anxiety during the pandemic than I think I ever have in my life.
Sure, sure. I mean, it feels like things are just out of control.
Well, you know, complicated grieving is certainly part of this. My mom died on March 30th at the age of 95, and it was difficult to get a funeral home to take her. It was difficult we couldn't come together and mourn. You know, we couldn't be together as a family. We couldn't even cry as much as we wanted to, because crying is so much facilitated, you know, by being together. And so there is a complicated grief reaction that I think needs to be appreciated as well.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your mom. I know that for many families, that is a very sad and familiar story. Let's take another short break and get back to our conversation. That's Roy Richard Grinker, our guest. And again, he's got a new book. It's called Nobody's Normal: How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. And he's a professor at the George Washington University. You can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us like Paul did, 1-888-477-9499. Much to discuss after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Roy Richard Grinker. He's a professor of anthropology and international affairs at the George Washington University, author of a new book titled Nobody's Normal: How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. His earlier book is titled Unstrange Minds: Remapping the World of Autism. Let me go back to this notion of stigma and the kind of invisibility of so many mental illnesses, in that you can't do an X-ray, you know, like a broken bone. You can do an X-ray and there's the broken bone. We can't do that with mental health or mental illness. Is that part of this struggle that we have in trying to understand it and destigmatize it?
Yeah, you know, as much as we've seen a tremendous growth in the neurosciences, the Manual of Mental Disorders, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, is still a purely descriptive document. There's nothing in there about pathophysiology. There, with the exception of a couple of things like PTSD and perhaps, you know, complicated grief, there really aren't any causes that are identified. And we've made very little progress in developing any new medications over the past decades, truly new medications. And so, you know, this invisibility becomes a way that can create fear in many communities. There is this idea at the highest levels of mental health leadership in this country that we'll get rid of the stigma of mental illness if we can define them completely as brain disorders, that there's something wrong with the brain. But that has yet to bear any fruit. In fact, the more people – I write about this in Nobody's Normal – that the more people start to see mental illnesses as a brain disorder rather than as a complex interaction between a person and their environment and their experience in history, the more they become afraid of mental illnesses, the more they want it to be invisible and stigmatize them.
You mentioned war, and you write a lot about what we have learned from war. It's had different names, you know, over the years, of PTSD, of the trauma of war. Has that helped us understand mental illness and, frankly, mental health?
Yes. It's very hard to say anything positive about wars, right? Nobody Yep. wants to say that wars are good. But wars are productive in the sense that they do produce changes. They are cataclysmic experiences. And every one of us has received, everybody listening to this show has received some sort of medical intervention at some point in their lives that probably traces directly to the military. If you are trans and you've had gender-affirming surgery, well, that surgery was initiated during World War I in order to repair the genitalia of soldiers who had been injured by ammunition. And the same is true for mental illnesses. The DSM was a military document. Some of the very first treatments that were short-term treatments in which you weren't hospitalized for mental illnesses were carried out in the military. Wars, because they're universal stressors and they affect everybody, also kind of normalize mental illnesses to say, hey, we're normal people in abnormal circumstances. And I think now that we're in a situation, this COVID pandemic, that many leaders, including President Biden, have likened to a war, we have an opportunity to actually jumpstart new aspects of mental health treatment and research. This is actually a kind of an opportunity for us.
Here's a question from Thomas. Interesting. Which mental illnesses are more prevalent in individualistic societies, I guess like the United States, and which are more prevalent in more collectivist societies? Have you looked at that?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. I don't want to answer it by giving prevalence figures because the epidemiology of psychiatric disorders is really variable. I once asked somebody who's the expert on eating disorders, you know, what's the prevalence of eating disorders in different societies? And he answered, what prevalence rate would you like? But what I would
to
say,
wow,
so much variability. It's a tough one. But what I would like to say is that the outcomes are different. So take schizophrenia, for example. There is really good, robust research documenting that people in highly industrial societies, particularly like in London and in Washington, D.C., who have schizophrenia, have worse outcomes, have more psychotic episodes, have more severe psychotic episodes than people in rural communities in India and in Nigeria. Why would that be the case? If it's the same condition and roughly the same prevalence, about 1%. I don't like to give these figures, but why would that be the case? And the only conclusion that people have come to is that in the non-industrial societies, there's less emphasis on people being autonomous and individual and independent, and there is more social support. There is more of a social network. So as the father of a child with autism, well, an adult now with autism, I have put all my eggs in that network basket. You know, I try to build up all the family and friend supports that I can because I know that of all the things that are out there, whether it's medication or counseling or whatever it is, the number one factor that influences better outcomes for mental illnesses is social support.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like we've got Robert, and Robert is calling us from Doylestown. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. My question, and then a quick personal statement. The question is Asperger's syndrome. You've mentioned autism spectrum a lot. In your experience, where do you see, is Asperger's like a autism light? And the reason I'm asking this is because I have a 25-year-old son who has a master's degree in mechanical engineering from a prestigious school. He has struggled to get a job in his field because he's been diagnosed with Asperger's, and he's now owned it, and he will you know, in varied interviews will be, I have Asperger's, or he'll admit that and say, I'm an introvert. I don't interview well. I don't do well with small talk. It's quite a baffling thing to deal with. So any opinions?
Oh, Robert, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. It's such an important issue. Roy, you want to respond?
Sure. I'll try to respond briefly, but it's such a good question, and I'm so glad you brought up Asperger's because it relates directly to the thesis of Nobody's Normal. First of all, you know, I've had this experience where my daughter, you know, she tried to get a job, tried. It's very, very difficult to do, but I applaud your son for being open and taking ownership of this term. And, you know, we had occasion once where she was she got a job briefly, held it very briefly. And we said, well, let's talk about her autism. And they said, oh, she can do her job fine. We don't need to talk about the autism. Well, she could get the job, but she couldn't hold it because they wouldn't allow us to talk about autism. Because, you know, having autism means that there are going to be other challenges down the road that people are going to face. Someone I profile in the book hired people with Asperger's to Morgan Stanley to do computer coding, and they did their work so well. They did their work so fast, but they didn't know how to ask for additional work. And so all the manager's reports were, seems to be loafing, you know, not paying attention, playing video games, wandering around. Nobody had gone to that next level. Now, having said that, let me just say that Asperger's is really connected to the history of stigma, particularly of autism, because it's no longer considered to be a valid psychiatric category by the expert community. It never was thought to be easy to distinguish Asperger's from any other kind of autism. It's just autism without the language delay. But we developed the term Asperger's in the early 90s, mid-90s, as a less stigmatizing term for autism to denote that there were people who weren't like the people who needed perhaps lifelong care in an institution, that there was a difference. And now that we've destigmatized autism and can talk about the autism spectrum, we no longer need Asperger's. So it's not that there was some scientific advance or some new knowledge. It was that culture did its work to destigmatize autism, and now we don't need Asperger's anymore.
And hopefully that message will spread and your son can have more success finding a job. And he's obviously extremely well-educated. Let me get to Rich from Eagleville to join our conversation. And Rich, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, my call. Great show.
Thanks.
Just have a comment. I guess, and this goes for all illnesses and whatnot, you still have to be your own best advocate. I think my wife is being treated for anxiety and medicated and for a year, and I just kept thinking to myself and telling her, you have a condition, you have something, you're not losing it. And we finally got into down at a different hospital, and you know, they said, oh sure, you got Parkinson's. So it was just a real, you know, setback. Oh, this time wasted, I just think it shows that people shouldn't just be pigeonholed as, okay, you have anxiety. That's, you know, we'll treat it with medicines and such. I just think you have to get certainly multiple opinions.
Sure. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I mean, Roy. Diagnosis is so important, and when it's a misdiagnosis, it can really send you down the wrong path.
I think this is one of the things that my grandfather used to emphasize. He would hold these little seminars with me when I was a kid and try to teach me different things. And he was very much invested in the idea of the integration of body and mind, and that we can't say, oh, there are mental illnesses and there are physical illnesses, because the two are intertwined. It doesn't really make sense to separate those out. People who are suffering from all kinds of illnesses have mental physical illnesses, have mental health consequences. Mental health itself affects our physical being. And so I think that there aren't enough multidisciplinary teams out there, and there are not enough people who are kind of integrating both medical care and psychiatric care to account for what used to be called psychosomatic conditions. Now people don't use that word as much anymore because people felt that when we thought that physical symptoms had a psychiatric component, it was highly stigmatizing. But I think this is an area that needs to be addressed. For my grandfather's part, in 1951, at a cost of $2 million, he built an institute with 95 researchers to study the complex interactions between psychological and physical conditions. And he warned that only the false separation between body and mind would perpetuate the stigma of mental illness.
Before I had this job back in the 1970s, I was a case manager working in Philadelphia. And this was in the period of deinstitutionalization. I mean, I was there to sort of watch these large institutions be closed and people sent to the community, I have to say, with mixed results. But nonetheless, now what we read is that the prisons have become the new mental institutions, and that's where people go because you cannot, you know, have some kind of long-term hospital facility to take care of someone's enduring mental illnesses.
Yeah, that's true. Prisons are the number one provider of mental health care right now. The idea of deinstitutionalization in the early 60s, it was the Community Mental Health Act was the last law that President John F. Kennedy signed before he was assassinated. The idea was to bring people into the community, to release them from these many deplorable institutions and asylums. But what happened was that the funding wasn't there, and the political enthusiasm wasn't there, and it ended up basically dumping people onto the street. And so homelessness and all kinds of other conditions, including severe poverty, resulted. I mean, so much so that some people who advocated strongly in the past for deinstitutionalization are having second thoughts, and they're saying, well, there was this one asylum that was really good in upstate New York. Maybe that would be a model for the future. But unless we can do things at the community level, this problem is going to persist.
We're almost out of time here, but we began our conversation and you were talking about these periods in human history when we are more accepting of diversity and then things seem to kind of shrivel up and go back to the way they were. Do you think we're at a moment where we can make actual progress on this notion of mental illness?
I feel like we are, but I want to be cautious. In 1946, my grandfather was on NBC radio and he said, "We've finally eradicated the stigma of mental illness." Wow. Well, that was premature. In the 1920s, the LA Times ran a story that said everyone has a mental illness. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And yet we still find ourselves here a century later having to have this conversation. I think that, you know, the most important thing is we're having this conversation, that we are talking. That people are listening, that they're asking questions, that my students are talking. You know, people are now talking about mental illnesses almost colloquially, where the person who is, you know, a neatnik says they have OCD, or the person who's suffered terribly from an experience says they have PTSD. Using this language doesn't minimize or make those conditions mundane. They can be so serious. But I think talking about it does disarm those words, and we can speak more openly and embrace more fully mental illnesses as a fundamental aspect of the human condition.
Roy Richard Grinker, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, his new book is called Nobody's Normal: How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for those calls and comments. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.